Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. The usual two guests on tap today. First, in a minute or two, we'll hear from Kathy Weeks, author of The Problem with Work, who will help us imagine a world in which material welfare is separated from the job, a quasi-utopia in which we'll work less and enjoy life more. Then a little past the half-hour mark, we'll hear from Steve Horn, who's been investigating the role of the Chicago-based Joyce Foundation in the so-called education reform agenda, which means charters, union busting, and lots of standardized tests. My first guest is Kathy Weeks, author of The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries, published by Duke University Press. The book is not new. It came out in 2011, but we're not fixated on the commercial value of new here on Behind the News. I've been meaning to interview her for some time now and have finally gotten around to it. Watching the bourgeois feminist line up to cheer on Facebook exec Sheryl Sandberg a few months ago with her book Lean In made me want to counter it with a different kind of feminism, one tied to a critique of capitalism and not one that just wants to get women seats at the corporate table. Kathy Weeks is a professor of women's studies at Duke. Kathy Weeks. Welcome, Kathy. First of all, let's get some terms defined, particularly work. What is this work you have a problem with?
I have a problem with most forms of work, but I use the term sort of narrowly, but also kind of broadly. So usually when I'm talking about work, I'm talking about the system of waged work, because that is the paradigmatic model of what we think of as work. But I also recognize and try to point out the ways that what counts as work is also culturally contested. So in some ways, certain forms of unwaged labor are also part of this system of work. So the system of wage work couldn't function, for example, if workers weren't reproduced on a daily and generational basis, and most of that labor is unwaged. So work is both sort of specific. I'm really focusing mostly on the system of wage labor, but it's not confined to that.
And now you review some mostly Marxist critiques of work we've seen in the past, which you could characterize one as a tradition of wanting to socialize work and somehow making it better, or humanizing work and making it better. First of all, what are these alternatives and what's your problem with them?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to focus on the ways that certain kinds of Marxist traditions have really ended up reproducing rather than contesting the ethics of work that are specific to capitalism. So one of these is a sort of, I guess, a kind of classical Marxism. I use Lenin as the example, where it really kind of celebrates the productive powers of workers and really celebrates that as the essence of what it means to be human and what will bring us to a better kind of social formation. But the other tradition is, you know, something that really was popularized more in the 1960s in what I'm calling a humanist Marxism that really sort of takes over this, what I think of as a mythology of our natural laboring essence, you know, that humans are by nature productive creatures and that the vision of a future is one where that productivity is unhampered by the relations of capitalist production. So it's a vision of not only non-exploited labor, but unalienated labor.
And how do these relate to Marx's somewhat appealing evocation of a world in which we could be, you know, fish and hunt and be a critical critic all in one day?
Yeah, you know, Terrell Carver has a great essay where he talks about that famous passage from the German Ideology. And he argues that in the original text, it shows that Engels wrote it. And so you have this, you know, classic tradition of blaming Engels for this, but that Marx added to that passage in the margins in a way that had the effect of casting it as a send-up of the kind of pastoral pre-modern visions of the utopian socialists that Marx rejected. So I really think it's misguided to even think of that as a Marxist utopia.
Well, Marx himself was not exactly a fan of utopias.
Well, you know, it depends on how we understand them in some ways. So I think in some ways they rejected the utopianism of the utopian socialists because it was just sort of, you know, this matter of, you know, grand plans and making blueprints that could be handed off to some social actor. But I think that they really did have a sense of the power of utopianism. It just didn't come out in the formation of a blueprint. It was rather about trying to inspire social actors to, you know, take charge of their own destiny. But I think that's also a species of utopianism in both thinking and writing. So I classify them as utopians, despite their own disavowal of the term.
But then the utopia is not something that something you take off the shelf, but in fact is something that's invented through experimentation and struggle.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I think there's forms of utopian writing and cultural production that have the goal of not sort of producing a vision, but of challenging people to exercise their own political imagination and their own forms of political experimentation. So I have a very, you know, a broader understanding of what counts as a utopia.
You know, utopia has been under a considerable attack over the last couple of decades, both on the left and the right for, among other things, being a route to the gulag, but also, you know, a lot of skepticism about inventing new worlds, much too ambitious, or you're speaking for someone else when you shouldn't be speaking for someone else. A reluctance in general to be ambitiously utopian. You want to resurrect the concept. What is its usefulness?
Oh, well, I mean, again, because I think of it more broadly than just, you know, some blueprint of some future, which I don't find particularly useful. I think it's incredibly valuable to think about not only what's wrong with the present, but what we might want instead. And I don't think we have many opportunities to exercise that kind of political imagination. And I think utopianism in all different forms, I mean, whether it's utopianism in music or in writing or in the carnival of protest events, that these, I think, are really useful sparks to get us to sort of think differently and to imagine what we might want. And I think that's a really important part of any kind of political process.
And another thing that has fallen out of fashion that you write at some length with approval is the concept of the political demand. Certainly the Occupy movement was very reticent about making demands, but you celebrate it. Why is that?
Yeah. And again, I don't think that you want to make demands in every situation. So I think the Occupy movement was, you know, I think had some very good reasons for not in a particular moment offering demands. But I really learned a lot from the 1970s Wages for Housework feminist literature. And I didn't learn about, you know, what to demand, but I learned a lot about what a demand is and what it could do. So I'm really interested in thinking about demands, not just as specific reforms. So, for example, reforms like the demand for shorter hours or a basic income that could improve the situation of individuals relative to work, but that could also function as critical perspectives, as provocations to the political imagination. Demands can also sort of make certain problems visible. They can set the agenda for critical analysis and discussion. So I'm really interested in the ways that demands can function to not just announce a particular reform that's desired on the part of a particular group, but also the practice of demanding can also change the terms of political discourse and the collectives themselves who are making the demands. So I think demands also have a kind of non-instrumental or non-strictly instrumental utility.
Yeah, I think you could call it, at one point, a declaration of collectivity and desire.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like that very much. I want to return to the Wages for Housework movement in a bit, but I want to talk some about the movement out of which that emerged, autonomous Marxism, particularly Italy in the 70s. What's the vision of work in that tradition that inspires you?
Well, I'm really interested in this sort of complicated concept that comes out of the autonomous tradition, and that includes the Wages for Housework tradition, And it's the concept of the refusal of work. And I'm very attracted to this. And I think the slogan refers to a number of things. At one level, it's, you know, literal. I mean, the strike is an example of a refusal of work. But at another kind of more theoretical level, the refusal of work is also signals an interest in thinking critically about the present world of work. And so not just about this job or that job, but work as a system, right? Work as a cultural way of life, and really try to think more critically about the way that it's functioning and the way that the ethical discourse that sustains it also shapes our existence. So it's really a critique, not just of production, but of productivism, not just a critique of work, but a critique of the work ethic. And then finally, at another level, the refusal of work is also, it's also meant to evoke the possibility of a mode of life that's not subordinated to work in the way it is today. So it's really about a provocation to imagine the parameters of a post-work future in work, in which work still exists, but it's not, but it's part of life, right? Not so much the whole of life. So I'm really attracted to this concept, both a theoretical concept and a practical concept of the refusal of work. And that's something that I find really in the autonomous tradition in a way that I don't find it as much in other kinds of Marxist traditions, or at least it doesn't, you know, it's not so central to other traditions.
I'm speaking with Kathy Weeks, professor of women's studies at Duke and author of The Problem with Work. Funnily enough, I once had a 1974 Fiat that was a product of a society that was in the grip of some kind of refusal of work. It was a terrible car and broke down all the time. But I think a lot of people will listen to you and think, you know, what is going to keep the electricity on in this refusal of work? We are so, you know, acculturated to the idea of the importance of work and labor that it's impossible to imagine a world, a different world.
I think that's true. And I think that's very interesting. I mean, I think that the lack of our own imagination of a life that's not centered on work is really interesting. And the fact that we have such trouble imagining what we would do and how we would come together, how we can imagine a kind of social cohesion that's not predicated on work, I find that all very interesting and very telling. I think that itself tells us how much we've been shaped in relationship to and constructed in and through this mandate to work and to be productive.
But I think as returning to the 74 Fiat, people hear this and say, you know, the damn thing didn't work. You know, I won't be able to drive to the supermarket. In this world you're imagining, would there be cars and supermarkets?
You know, I'm not imagining this world. I mean, that's part of my interest in a utopia that's not offering blueprints, but just trying to think provocatively. So one of the things I am advocating are certain reforms that I think might lead us to be able to think more about a different relationship to work. So the two reforms that I'm interested in are for shorter hours and for a guaranteed basic income. And I think both of those reforms would in some ways alter somewhat our relationship to work, you know, that would make that relationship between and work and income less absolute. So some people could opt out of work, at least for some periods. But I think it might allow us also to sort of begin to imagine what we cannot really imagine now is what would a different system of production look like where work was not necessarily a lifetime requirement for every individual.
You know, as I was reading your book, I was thinking of the recent phenomenon of Sheryl Sandberg and Leaning In. And that's what bourgeois feminism has really embraced with a passion now. But feminism wasn't always such, was it?
No. It was, I mean, that was always a dominant voice in feminism, but not always, you know, the only voice in it. I mean, I always think of sort of feminist demands around work as falling on two different sides. On one hand, there's this effort to try to include women in the system of waged work as equals. And I think she represents, you know, that kind of feminism. And then there's another kind of feminist effort around work that focused on gaining social recognition and support and men's equal responsibility for unwaged domestic work. And I think she's not speaking to that at all. But I think the problem with both of these is they end up sort of not only reproducing a kind of very standard work ethic discourse when they sing the praises either of waged work for women or unwaged domestic work for everyone, but also they end up especially in that second effort, to really sort of reproduce a certain kind of family's values discourse, so that between the two of those projects, our choices are reduced to either waged work or family. And I think both of those are problematic in and of themselves.
Yeah, a lot of this discourse ends up with the work-family balance issue, but you reject that.
Mm-hmm.
In part because you're looking for different ways of living than the conventional family.
Yeah, I mean, I think a part of this, I'm trying to sort of work within a feminist tradition that's critical of both work and family. And I think that's really illustrated best by the wages for housework tradition from the 1970s.
Okay, let's talk about them some, because I think a lot of modern feminists look back on that, if they think of it at all, as something of an embarrassment or just a quaint relic from a different time. What do you find that's valuable from that moment?
I guess, one of the things I've talked about already is, their understanding of what a demand is and what it could do. And I thought they had a very clear understanding that, a demand is a kind of a piece of performance art in some ways, too. I mean, it was never clear if the proponents of wages for housework ever wanted wages for housework, which they demanded. In some ways, they used that demand as a tool of education and provocation. They were trying to get people to realize that housework is work, right? That the system of wage work couldn't survive without it in some ways. And to say that it deserved a wage was one way of making that point very visible. So I think they had other goals besides just that reform in mind. And I found that very interesting. But also, again, going back to the critique of the family. I mean, I think that's something that dropped off the feminist agenda since the 1970s as well. And I think it's important to revive that. And I think the work-family balance is a perfect target for that. I mean, work and family are not just out of balance. They're in flagrant contradiction. I mean, they can't coexist in some ways. So I think the wages for housework tradition is really useful for their critique of both of those institutions and for their adherence to this project of refusing the work ethic, both the work ethic and the family ethic.
And at the same time as making radical demands, in some sense, it also reinforced the notion of a wage system, but also of a woman as housewife.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've never thought that the demand for wages for housework was a particularly good idea in and of itself. Because even though they were arguing that it was a demand for, wages for housework, not for housewives, in the discourse, it was quite clear that the people doing the housework were really housewives. And so as people argued from the very beginning, all that does is reinforce a kind of gender division of labor rather than trying to disrupt it, that it would actually institutionalize it even more than it was institutionalized now. And I agree with that critique. So I do think that the particular demand itself was very limited and in some ways even counterproductive.
So you have updated that to a new set of demands, shorter weeks, and you actually summarize the autonomous demand as less work, more money.
Mm-hmm.
Some variety of that, right? A basic income and less work, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. So just lay out what you have in mind there.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways that what the refusal of work, and particularly I think most powerfully in its feminist instantiation with wages for housework, it was really an effort to try to sort of demand that social wealth be sort of distributed in terms of more free time. And so the demands for shorter work week and a basic income, I think, are ways to start thinking about short-term goals that might point in a different kind of direction. So, for example, the demand for basic income, I think, has a lot of potential as what I call a utopian demand. That is not a demand that we're going to win easily or in a very short-term calculus. But I think that it's one that could really help to spark the imagination of what a life that wasn't so relentlessly subordinated to work might look like. So on the one hand, the basic income could offer some really tangible support. It could give support for the people who are unwaged, underwaged, precariously waged. It could give workers a stronger bargaining position to negotiate better work. It could give individuals some relief from all of the pressures that constrict their choices about family participation and household membership. And it could give support for all of that unwaged work, including unwaged domestic caring labor that feminists have long been arguing for. So I think a basic income, I think, could really improve a lot of people's relationship to work and improve their lives. But at the same time, I think it's very provocative, and that it helps us imagine, you know, what would we do if we had the possibility of working less, or of not working at all, if the basic income was at a sufficient level. So I find these demands really useful, not just as terminal points, but as steps, as strategies, as ways of sort of expanding our horizons of what's possible.
They're utopian, but they're not outlandish.
Right.
I mean, there's a certain practical utopianism to them.
Yes, exactly. And that's why I put those terms together, utopian and demand. I mean, we think of a demand as something that's very practical, very immediate, you know, very legible. The utopia has the opposite connotation. So I think putting them together sort of allows you to think about the possibility of demands that are in some ways very reasonable. I mean, the system of wage work is not working right now. It's not working as a system of income distribution or social belonging. And I think a guaranteed basic income could help fix a system that's broken. So in some ways, it's a very, you know, legible, clear, rational sort of demand. But on the other hand, I'm really interested in the utopian horizon it might open up to, especially when we think about, you know, the demand for basic income as not the revolution, right? It's just a step that might alter our relationship with work enough so that we can imagine other kinds of futures. So I'm interested in the horizon it opens up as well.
I'm thinking about the where we are right now in this chronically underemployed economy, persistent high unemployment and underemployment. And I think a lot of people would just like a job. How do you get around that perception and make this agenda politically appealing to people who would just like some kind of ordinary work?
Yeah, I mean, in this system that, you know, in order to live, you have to work. Yeah. I mean, we do have to demand jobs, just as in a system that is organized around, you know, the marriage relationship. I think people who are excluded from that institution need to demand to be included in that institution. I just don't think our politics should stop with the demand for inclusion into the existing systems of work and family. I think we also need to couple them with demands that, again, open up a kind of utopian horizon, too. So, yes, of course, in this time and in this place, people need income, and the way to get it is through work. I just don't want our politics to be limited to those very, very pragmatic goals. I want to include goals that are also, again, a little bit more far-reaching.
And I'm thinking also more in the practical politics of this, of intellectuals, academics, people like you and me. Our lives are hard to separate from work. Our lives are very much wrapped up with our work. On the other hand, we've got people who are looking for something more than 25 hours a week at the Walmart because that's all they can get. Is there some way that this agenda could appeal to people at both extremes of that relation with work?
Yes, and that's one of the reasons I'm interested in this agenda. I'm tired of some of the older agendas that were very limited in their imagination of the class composition that would fuel certain demands. And I think most of us are dissatisfied with work. And I think those who don't have enough work, right, the unemployed, the underemployed, have problems with work. And I think the overemployed and the overworked have problems with work. And so I want to try to think about a kind of critique of work and imagination of alternatives that could benefit people at both ends of the spectrum. And I think a shorter working day could you know, boost up some kinds of part-time work to the status of full-time work, for example, but also could be used to limit, you know, the working day for those who are suffering from overwork. So I'm sort of interested in trying to think about a politics of work, both in its critical and in its utopian or visionary dimensions, that could bring different groups of people who are situated very differently in relationship to the work system, could bring them together to begin to sort of think critically about how the system is failing just about everybody.
I'm speaking with Kathy Weeks, professor of women's studies at Duke and author of The Problem with Work. And we are so, of course, as I said earlier, so acculturated to this. I mean, a friend of mine says we're all in the grip of a psychosis of work. How do you break out of that? How do you kind of rewire the common sense that people are have drilled into them from birth?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I really want to take aim at the work ethic, and that this critique that I'm mounting is really directed at how we value and, I think, overvalue work relative to other kinds of practices. In some ways, I think this is something for every individual to think about in their own relationship to work and what shapes it and what are the costs and benefits of one's own orientation to work. But I think the project of altering both the structure and the culture of work is a collective project, and it's going to be a long and hard-fought one. So I think it's really about trying to imagine forms of struggle that might help us begin to think differently. I don't know if we can really break the hold of the work ethic. I think it goes very deep, this overcommitment to work. But I also think at the same time, you talk to those same people, they complain about their work too. I mean, everyone understands the problems with work too. So I think it's trying to work some of those contradictions, our overinvestment with work and our disappointment with work at the same time.
As I was reading the book, I kept thinking of that quote from Marlowe in Heart of Darkness. I don't like work, no man does, but I like what is in the work, the chance to find yourself, your own reality for yourself, not for others, what no other man can ever know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that view of work?
You know, I find myself arguing against efforts to imagine and struggle for non-alienated work, work that would deliver all its promises, that would be fulfilling, that would help us in our own self-development, that would bring us together as communities who are working cooperatively. That is a sort of utopian vision of work, and I find myself really impatiently frustrated with it right now, because I find that what had been, I think, a really powerful left vision has been so co-opted. Google, that's what it purports to offer its employees. You know, we'll make work fun. We will help you develop all of your skills and talents through work. Now, at some level, that's just, a human resources speak. In other ways, I think the work is, made better through some of these efforts. But I think that what's really true is that all of this language of work improvement, where we will help employees to realize themselves, has been an excuse for work intensification, right? And I'm afraid that we're getting what we've dreamt of, where work is the whole of life, where we imagine that work, can save us as individuals and a society. And I think employers try to offer workers something that they think resembles that. So I'm just worried that all of these dreams of non-alienated fulfilling work, that those dreams have been co-opted in some ways. And I don't find them particularly useful at this point. Now, of course, I want work to be better, and we should always struggle to improve the quality of work. But in some ways, I'm worried about that demand to the extent that it's severed from a demand that should always go with it, which is the demand for less work.
Yeah, the temptation to be reasonable is sometimes fatal, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, it is. Well, that's the importance of utopianism, too.
Yeah. But as I was saying earlier, for a lot of intellectuals, academics, a lot of people in the professional managerial classes, so much of their life is organized around work. What are you holding forth as the non-work portion of life that should be the temptation to imagine a different kind of world, imagine a post-work utopia?
Mm. And, this is where I become very frustrating, is what I do is I critique everyone else's ideas of what that would be. Because I really, again, I'm struck by our lack of imagination of what non-work would be. And so I find that a lot of people say, well, give us an example, of what kinds of activities and practices that we would engage in if we had more time off work. And, the examples that people have offered me have often been really like backward-looking and nostalgic, or else sort of upward looking, looking to the leisure classes, for examples of what we would do with more non-work time. And I really want to sort of resist the example in this in some ways. And I think rather than rather than searching for examples of non-work in the past or the present, you know, finding examples historically or in other places and times, I think it's more important to tether our imagination of it to the future so that we think of non-work as not something to recover or to defend, but rather something to invent. And that's what I'm really, really interested in trying to provoke, is not examples of it, you know, that I could point to, well, some people do this, some people do that, but really that it's a project that we really need to work through. So I find myself really resisting what seems like a pretty reasonable call to give examples of what non-work and might look like and what we would do with more non-work time.
Well, I admire the stubbornness. Thanks. Okay. That was Kathy Weeks, a professor of women's studies at Duke and author of The Problem with Work, Feminism, Marxism, Anti-Work Politics, and Post-Work Imaginaries, published in 2011 by Duke University Press. Two of the many things I like about the book are her celebration of the productive power of the political demand and her unashamed utopianism, which is a nice antidote to my usual skepticism and despair. That plus her radical intelligence, which is visible on every page. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break.
Sometimes it seems that way.
That was some of We Live As We Dream Alone by the Gang of Four, which quotes from Conrad's Heart of Darkness, just as I did in the Kathy Weeks interview, and which evokes a fantasy of non-alienated work, which we now know is not unproblematic. Next up is Steve Horn. Steve Horn is a freelance journalist based in Madison, Wisconsin. His investigation of the relationship between the Chicago-based Joyce Foundation and the public school privatization agenda in that city was published on the web by mintpressnews.com. Steve Horn. Welcome, Steve. So you've been investigating the education reform movement, a great scam across the country, and you find the Joyce Foundation at the center of everything. Who is the Joyce Foundation?
Sure. So the Joyce Foundation was started in the late 1940s by a family with lots of money from the timber industry, and it's kind of been a mainstay in sort of the Chicago liberal elite circles since then. Really, it wasn't until the mid-90s or so, you know, when the nationwide push to charterize schools and testing regime started, that Joyce kind of joined that crowd. And during that time, President Barack Obama, even before he was a state-level senator, was on the board of directors of the Joyce Foundation. He was on Joyce Foundation board from 1994 through 2002. And during that time, in 1995, there was something called the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, which was a $49 million funding effort by the Annenberg Foundation and like sort of bringing every Chicago area group together under one umbrella to retool Chicago schools. I think a lot of even people on the left were involved. I know that even Bill Ayers got involved in the Chicago Annenberg Challenge, but ended up leaving, and the effort morphed into what in 1998 turned into the Chicago Public Education Fund, which was sort of a venture capital fund or something that's like a public-private effort between foundations, corporate elites, and City of Chicago itself to retool, again, the Chicago public school into what we see now today. So the first ever charter school in Chicago was built in 1996. And now today we're dealing with a situation in which there are 134 charter schools, lots of teachers being laid off. The most recent laying off was 550 teachers. And accompanying that laying off was sort of a flew under the radar was 570 Teach for America teachers being hired. And Joyce Foundation, for example, is a major funder of the Teach for America program. They've given, you know, tens of millions of dollars to the program in its first couple of decades in existence. So Joyce is well in line with foundations of the right that are pretty notorious, such as the Bradley Foundation, which is based out of Milwaukee, in terms of being in line with the same sort of, if you look at each prong of the education reform movement, Joyce is kind of joined the hands of foundations like Bradley Foundation in marching in lockstep with that agenda.
Now, just to emphasize the breadth of ideological commitment to this agenda, the Joyce Foundation has a history as a liberal foundation. It's not like the Bradleys, right?
Right, yeah. So I guess a clear difference would be on the guns issue. You know, Joyce is out there lobbying for gun control. Joyce is pushing for gun control, while Bradley is, you know, ruthlessly in line with the NRA's agenda on that. So they're not like a right wing foundation on every issue. I mean, they also fund the environmental movement, which again has its own problems. But you know, unlike Bradley, which is funding the climate change denial echo chamber, they are, you know, at least funding some efforts towards you know, regulations on carbon and things like that. So they're not, you know, it's erroneous to completely equate them with Bradley, but it is correct to say that they do share a common ideology on education reform.
You mentioned use the phrase venture philanthropy. Could you expand upon what that's all about?
It's basically the use of foundations and 501c3 nonprofits as sort of a tax shelter, if you will, for people with a lot of money, and also to push an ideological agenda. And it's mostly about the spread of ideas to the public, but also that turns into policy, because ideas, you know, if the public supports the agenda, that can then transform into a policy. So, you know, for example, you know, the Joyce Foundation gives a lot of money to a group like Advance Illinois, which is a think tank that puts out a lot of studies, all in support of charter schools and of the neoliberal K-12 education agenda. Advance Illinois is also very well connected to the Chicago political elite and Democratic Party circles. On the board of directors is not only Bill Daley, the former chief of staff of President Barack Obama, but also Ellen Alberding herself, who is the head of the Joyce Foundation right now. And you know, their studies get talked about in the mainstream media. Chicago Tribune itself will run a lot of stories about it. The Sun-Times will run stories about it, even national media. And then, you know, the way that a venture philanthropist looks at it is that these are sort of the seeds that they plant to create a movement for charter schools nationwide. So it's, and then, you know, charter schools itself are a big moneymaker for these people.
And to underscore the ties to the Obama administration, of course, Arne Duncan, now Secretary of Education, was the CEO, as they like to call him, of the Chicago Public Schools. Tell us about Duncan's history in Chicago.
Sure. Yeah. So Duncan, as you said, you know, in the early 2000s, became the chief executive officer of CPS. And during that time, there was a really key moment, in my opinion, that really illustrates, you know, the continuity of what's happened under Rahm Emanuel as the mayor. Rahm Emanuel being the former chief of staff of President Barack Obama. In 2006, the Chicago Public Schools under Duncan got a $27.5 million grant under the Teacher Incentive Fund from the Department of Education to implement something called the Real TAP program. The TAP system actually originated from Lowell Milken in late 1990s and early 2000s in the Milken Family Foundation.
That's, of course, Michael's younger brother, right?
Right, yeah. And you know, Lowell Milken himself invests lots of money in K-12 Inc., which is an online charter corporation, basically, that's now publicly traded on Wall Street. And in 2000, he put $10 million in that pot, and now that's worth $150 million because those schools have boomed so much. But Lowell Milken also now, in 2005, he started the National Institute on Excellence in Teaching, or the NIET. You know, the next year in 2006, that became basically Chicago Public Schools, more or less the agenda with his $27.5 million grant under Duncan. And Duncan himself pivoted off of this position as the CEO of CPS and is now implementing the same, which at that time was No Child Left Behind, has sort of rebranded these same efforts as Race to the Top as the head of the Department of Education. And in 2011, another grant was given for a similar program for $42 million for the Teacher Incentive Fund. So this is, and again, in line with the Race to the Top agenda, which means that if you don't meet the standards that are being set by these the neoliberal agenda, then your school can shut down. It means teachers can be laid off. And then, as I tried to point out in the article, that means that a lot of these teachers are going to be replaced with Teach for America teachers or various other programs like Teach for America, in which they're basically, as Mike Klonsky said in my interview with him, they're kind of fulfill the role as scabs, even though I don't think that most of them would think of themselves that way. Just if you look at it structurally, that's the, as teachers are, as the Chicago Teachers Union is going on strike and basically a burgeoning movement, Teach for America teachers are kind of serving as placeholders for a lot of these teachers who are being laid off.
I'm speaking with the investigative journalist Steve Horn. Okay, and then another connection to the Obama administration, of course, is the current mayor of Chicago, which some people optimistically are referring to him as the one-term mayor of Chicago, the obscene Rahm Emanuel. What's he been up to?
Sure. So, under Rahm Emanuel, and this also goes back to these Joyce Foundation ties, and I'll try to illustrate that, this agenda has just been ratcheted up and worsened to a degree that most people wouldn't have ever imagined. Late in the spring of this year, Rahm Emanuel was responsible for the closing of 50 schools, and then, not too long after, was responsible for the firing of 550 teachers. So under his watch, dozens of schools have been closed, over 1,000 teachers have been laid off, and this is all in line with a lot of the funding efforts of the Joyce Foundation. One key example would be, the efforts of Stand for Children, which is a Joyce Foundation-funded group that I pointed out in the article. Stand for Children, right now, a lot of their PR efforts are being helped along by the former education program director of the Joyce Foundation. His name is John Luxack, who has his own little firm that he's one of the principals of called Education First. And he basically, behind the scenes, is doing a lot of the work for this. And then, while Rahm Emanuel, it's sort of like the men behind the curtain of the Rahm Emanuel agenda. Another example is the other former education program director of Joyce is a woman by the name of Angela Rudolph, who's now heads this group called Democrats for Education Reform, which works alongside this other group, Stand for Children. So that's a lot of the PR noise effort of the agenda, alongside what I talked about before, which is Advance Illinois, which Ellen Alberding is on the board of directors, Obama's former chief of staff, Bill Daley's on the board of directors. Bill Daley will be running for governor, he announced in 2014. And, I think even more importantly is another woman by the name of Elizabeth Swanson. She formerly worked for Duncan when he was at CPS, and then she went to a position to work for the Pritzker Family Foundation, Penny Pritzker being another sort of, right now in Obama's cabinet as the Secretary of Commerce. She also was instrumental in a lot of these efforts in the late 90s and early 2000s to fulfill this agenda. But Arne Duncan nationally is what Elizabeth Swanson is in Chicago. She's kind of like the Secretary of Education of CPS. So she left the job with Arne Duncan, went to work for the Pritzker Family Foundation for a while in the education program, and then left that position to basically run CPS, more or less.
Now, I'm not sure which metaphor to use, but these seem like the doors are revolving very rapidly, or these directorates interlocked very tightly.
Yeah, very tightly. And I think sort of the one big overarching fact that hasn't been discussed either on a national level or even in Chicago activist circles. I think it's because a lot of people still have illusions about who President Barack Obama is and where he came from. Is that, you know, that people don't want to really talk about how he was, you know, he sort of planted the seeds of a lot of this when he was on the board of directors of the Joyce Foundation. And what we're talking about now really started happening when, before anyone really knew who President Obama was, even before he was a state level senator, but, you know, the right people knew who President Obama was. That's when he was getting to know the people that would, you know, fund his future campaigns. That's when he would become more close with people like Penny Pritzker, for example, or anyone else, any of the other scores of people who are, you know, helping fund this agenda. They're now funding his campaigns. So it's sort of a, it's not really the way, and often it's just talked about, is this is Rahm Emanuel's agenda alone. And I think it, you know, obviously I think my article tries to point out that it runs much deeper than that. And there's all kinds of interlocking directorates and revolving doors that really have made this possible. And I think at the center of it was not the only person, but, you know, a key person was President Barack Obama before he was well known.
And of course, we shouldn't let Penny Pritzker's name go by without noting that she, the family, is the Hyatt Hotel chain, which is notoriously anti-union.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, Penny Pritzker herself was on the, as I mentioned before, she was on the Chicago Public Education Fund Board of Directors. She was also on the Chicago Board of Education, basically the Board of Directors of CPS itself. So she's been really closely tied to every single effort, you know, plus her foundation, which could be an article in of itself. The Pritzker Family Foundation funds a lot of these efforts too. Kind of, you know, the same things that Joyce is funding are the same things that the Pritzker Family Foundation is funding. And now, you know, Penny Pritzker first was on President Barack Obama's. He had some sort of jobs, some kind of economic advisory panel in his first term, which also Jeff Immelt, the CEO of General Electric, which doesn't, you know, some years doesn't even pay for taxes. He was the head of this committee. But Penny Pritzker first did that for the Obama administration. Now she's actually the head of the, you know, she's a Secretary of Commerce, the head of the Department of Commerce. So it's really shows how tight these people, the circle is. And, you know, they've come from Chicago in the 90s to top of the U.S. government.
Now, this underscores a point that Adolf Reed made in the show last week about how Obama is the first president really to emerge out of this foundation nonprofit world. I mean, that is kind of his origins and his base.
Right. Right. And it's like a sort of this whole world that has really only been explored in good depth, I think, on the right. If you look at a lot of people spend a lot of time, not I don't think it's a bad thing, but there's a lot of time spent talking about the Bradley Foundation, the Koch Family Foundation, and all these other, you know, you name it, there's a whole cabal that's written about in that sphere. But if you look at the liberal foundation world, it's kind of a little taboo to talk about still, although I think that it's really important to talk about. And, you know, President Obama is a good case in point, but so is Secretary of Commerce Penny Pritzker, you know, so is Arne Duncan, and, you know, I guess the list goes on. But it's just underexplored, I think. It's not definitely not new. These foundations have been around for decades, but it's, especially the liberal foundations are not looked at in the same light, although they should be, as the right-wing foundations.
And it should be underscored also that they're redesigning a major public sector institution, the public school system, pretty secretively and with no democratic accountability.
Right. And I think that's almost the most interesting part of what I couldn't get into in this Joyce Foundation article, is that talk about the unaccountability of the whole scene, is that it's hard to know exactly who's even giving money, almost impossible to know who's giving money to the Joyce Foundation. You know that what my article showed is who the Joyce Foundation gives money to, because they are transparent about that. But if you look behind the next curtain, that's a closed curtain. That's who's bankrolling the Joyce Foundation. And, you know, part of it is that the Joyce Foundation and every foundation gives a lot, you know, invests a lot of their money in other assets. And they only really give away about 5% of their money. That's like a standard practice of these big foundations. So what we don't know is A, who's giving that 5% of money, and then B, because, you know, their total endowment is $900 million. We also don't know what they're investing their money in at all, and that's not really for people to know. But as they're doing that, they are completely reshaping the public sector. And one key aspect of the public sector is, you know, schools. And but also in doing this, they're also part of this agenda is an anti-union agenda and breaking the back of unions. And as I said, sort of replacing these teachers who were union teachers with TFA teachers who are non-unionized, and you know, so they can, they're sort of inserting robots that can fulfill their preferred agenda for education, which is one that's not about it's really not about education at all. It's about testing and about basically creating robots to you know, be cogs in the machine for the next step in life, which is higher education for some, but for many, just a life without a, you know, without a job. They don't fit in within the agenda, so they're sort of left in this bubble that's being created of people who are unemployed or underemployed.
Yeah, of course, this is very much at odds with what the elite does with their kids. Their kids go to fancy schools with progressive agendas, with small classes, and none of these standardized tests.
Right, exactly.
That was Steve Horn, a freelance journalist based in Madison, Wisconsin, a regular contributor to mintpressnews.com, where his article, on which this interview is based, was published. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a snippet of the minuet from Beethoven's Piano Trio No. 3, performed by Daniel Barenboim, Jacqueline Dupre, and Pinka Sukerman. Till next week, bye.